ever catch yourself misremembering something really vividly, or like
Yeah.
feeling you saw something out of the corner of your eye and then it just vanished? What if those moments aren't just your brain glitching, but actually a key part of how your mind builds the reality you experience?
Yeah, that's a brilliant way to jump right into the core of what we're exploring today, which is, well, the endlessly fascinating, often puzzling world of consciousness.
Absolutely. And, we're not just floating around in philosophical space here. We've got a fantastic collection of material to guide us, including a really in-depth look at the neurocognitive theory of consciousness. It tackles this huge topic from a scientific angle, which I always appreciate for bringing some, well, concrete understanding to such an abstract area.
And what's particularly valuable about diving into these sources together is that they help us navigate this massive subject. They help pinpoint what truly matters about consciousness, without getting lost in endless theoretical debates.
Exactly. So our mission for this deep dive, which you've already signed up for by listening, is to extract the most vital insights about consciousness. We want to go beyond those trippy definitions and really understand how our brains create our unique personal experience of being alive and aware. And it maybe more importantly, explore why this understanding matters to how we see ourselves and the world around us. We get some genuinely surprising discoveries and moments ahead, I think. So let's get right to it.
Okay, so the first thing our sources make really clear is that pinning down a single neat definition of consciousness is incredibly challenging. It's like trying to hold water in your hands. The more you try to grasp it, the more elusive it becomes.
You're so right. It's like trying to define life itself. We know it when we see it, right? But a perfect definition is surprisingly hard to nail down. The chapter mentions Daniel Dennett's idea of contrastive heterophenomenology. Now, the key insight here, as I see it, is that we can learn about consciousness by looking at the difference between when we're conscious and when we're clearly not, like, awake versus deeply asleep.
Precisely. By examining these contrasts, we can start to map the edges of conscious experience, at least in humans. Our sources also touch on the ongoing discussions about whether animals, maybe even plants, might have some form of consciousness. They note their ability to learn and react.
Which really makes you think, the idea of a tree having some level of awareness.
Yeah.
But for now, our sources wisely keep us focused on human consciousness, setting aside those broader philosophical discussions for another time. Probably wise.
Yeah, definitely. This focus allows us to consider some more tangible ideas. John Locke, for instance, offered a classic definition: consciousness as the perception of what happens in one's own mind. It's that inner sense of our thoughts and feelings.
Right. And John Anderson builds on that, suggesting that consciousness might be the brain's way of solving a coordination problem. Like, think of our brain as having lots of specialized departments, each doing different tasks. Anderson proposes that consciousness, helped along by a global workspace, is how these departments share info and work together. So the crucial insight here is that our subjective experience might be the result of our brain's different departments sharing information on a central stage, allowing for integrated thought and action.
Exactly. And what's fascinating is Anderson's concept of the architecture of small worlds in the brain, lots of interconnected modules communicating through this central workspace. He even makes a provocative claim about his AI program, ACTR, suggesting it might potentially be conscious because it can perceive, model the world, and reflect on its working memory.
A conscious computer. That really makes you reconsider what consciousness even means, doesn't it? The chapter then links phenomenal consciousness, that inner experience we all have, to the brain's ability to essentially comment on and reflect on what's happening in this global workspace. Dutch emphasizes this too.
And this idea of the brain commenting on its own activity is key. It suggests that consciousness isn't just about processing information. It's also about having a kind of meta-awareness of that processing, like putting a spotlight on certain thoughts or activities.
Okay, now this leads to a really mind-bending idea. We don't actually perceive reality directly. We think we do,
Yeah.
right? Open our eyes, and there it is. But our sources argue that what we experience are actually the results of our brain's activity, that our brains construct a representation of reality.
That's a fundamental point, a really crucial one. And this constructed reality is also deeply personal, shaped by what's relevant or important to each of us. We become aware of the results of these incredibly complex brain processes, the information that lets us act, but not the vast unconscious processes that generate that information in the first place.
Think about those moments of sensory illusion, optical tricks, weird sounds you can't quite place, even tactile sensations that feel strange. They perfectly show how our perception is built, constructed, not just a straightforward feed from the outside world. Our brains are constantly interpreting, and sometimes those interpretations don't perfectly match physical reality.
Yeah, the chapter shares that powerful Zen story, the monk who unknowingly drinks water from a skull in the dark and finds it delicious, only to be horrified by the reality in the morning. His sudden revulsion and the realization that everything is the creation of the mind beautifully illustrates this constructed nature of our experience.
It's a great story. And it's fascinating that Hermann von Helmholtz, way back in the 19th century, noticed the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
That there isn't always a simple one-to-one relationship between what's out there physically and what we actually perceive subjectively.
Mm-hmm. And that idea took time to become widely accepted. But later attempts to build artificial vision systems really hammered the point home. As Chater notes, trying to create systems that could reliably understand visual information showed just how much unconscious work goes into what we experience as just seeing.
Okay, so if our perception is constructed, it makes you wonder, why are we aware of some of these brain processes and not others? What's the evolutionary point? The chapter quotes D'Arcy Thompson saying, "Everything is the way it is because it got that way." Which is a wonderfully concise way of looking at evolution, I think.
Exactly. It suggests we consciously perceive what's crucial for making decisions that affect our entire being. Decisions that require coordination and maybe thinking about consequences. Automatic actions, like walking, usually don't need that level of conscious oversight.
That makes perfect sense. You don't consciously think about every single step you take unless, you know, you're walking on ice or something tricky.
Yeah.
The chapter also mentions unusual brain states and disorders of consciousness, which really blur the lines between what we consider conscious and unconscious.
And these unusual situations are incredibly informative. They show us how fluid these states can be. The source also revisits the word consciousness itself, pointing out that it has so many different meanings, and they often vary between languages.
It's like trying to use one word to describe every type of building, from a shed to a skyscraper. It just doesn't capture the nuances. The chapter suggests that instead of getting stuck on one definition, it's more useful to investigate the specific conditions under which conscious experiences actually arise.
Yes, and it emphasizes that consciousness is likely a process, not a fixed thing. It even suggests a more dynamic way of talking about it might be helpful. Ultimately, any useful theory of consciousness needs to be grounded in real experiences, or at least the possibility of them, concrete examples.
Okay, so instead of this big, overwhelming question of what is it, we should be asking more specific, answerable questions. That feels much more manageable. Like, what needs to happen for us to have a conscious sensation? What are the ingredients?
Exactly. Our source highlights a few key ones. A strong enough signal, for starters. Then, our brain expecting that signal plays a role. Our focused attention on it is crucial. And finally, a coherent, coordinated activation across different brain regions.
That really lines up with everyday experience, doesn't it? You're more likely to notice a sudden loud noise if you were kind of expecting something and you were paying attention.
Yeah.
What about where these conscious sensations arise? Is there like a consciousness spot in the brain?
The chapter cautions against thinking about it that way. Mental states aren't neatly located in one single spot. It uses a great analogy. Where in a video game do the monsters exist? They're not just the pixels on the screen, right?
Yeah.
They're the result of complex code defining their appearance and behavior running on the hardware.
Okay. So it's more about the network and the activity happening across different brain areas. The chapter also considers how much our conscious experiences depend on what's happening outside of us. Are we just passively soaking up sensory info?
Not really, no. Our brains actively interpret the same information differently based on our internal state, our mood, our history. What one person notices immediately might just fade into the background noise for someone else.
And of course, the kind of sensation we have clearly depends on which of our senses is involved. Seeing is a very different experience from hearing or touching. It all comes back to those specific brain processes.
Right. And the chapter wraps up this part by reminding us that clear definitions of concepts are really only possible within the framework of specific theories, like those we use in AI.
That's a great lead-in to thinking about the mind itself. Our sources introduce the idea of the mind as a system designed to guide an organism's behavior in complex situations. That's from Newell and Simon, right?
Yes. And in AI, this leads to the creation of cognitive architectures, computer programs that try to model brain structures at a high level to explain how our minds function. Marvin Minsky's Society of Mind idea is also relevant here. It emphasizes that the mind isn't a single entity, but more like a collection of many interacting functions or agents.
Like a team of specialists working together on a big project. So a cognitive architecture is basically a collection of these specialized modules linked to different brain regions, and they're coordinated by some kind of central system that helps make connections between them.
Precisely. This central system tries to find relevant associations, you know, memories or concepts, to help us understand what's happening and decide how to respond based on the activity in these different modules.
And these mental functions include things we do every day. Perception, memory, recalling information, naming things, using symbols. But how does our sense of me, our identity, fit into this kind of model?
Well, identity, according to this view, is maintained through memory systems. They provide connections related to our representation of self in relation to whatever we're perceiving or thinking about. This allows us to have a consistent sense of self over time. And the evolution of primate brains has also led to more advanced control systems, the ability to process complex relationships, abstract thinking.
So while thinking about the mind as a computer program isn't a perfect analogy, it helps us understand that these mental functions aren't physical objects themselves. They're more about information and relationships between states.
Exactly. Mental processes have a rich structure, but they need a physical foundation, the matter of the brain, to actually happen. Information needs matter to be stored, and it needs energy to be changed and communicated.
So for a system that learns and perceives, information isn't just abstract code. It's the actual impact a signal has on how the system works, right? How it changes the system's state.
Yes, that's different from how we might talk about information in, say, a communication channel. And a key point is that the way information is presented, the specific computer language, for instance, is less important than what it does, how it triggers perception, memory recall, actions, and so on. A program can run on different types of computers, but it's still the same underlying information defining how it works.
So is a program physical or non-physical?
Yeah.
It sounds like it's abstract information that needs a physical platform, a substrate, to become real.
Mm.
And when we think about our brains, they've evolved for specific kinds of learning, which is why we have abilities that other animals don't, and vice versa. Our senses are limited in some ways compared to others.
Right. And while creating life from scratch is obviously a monumental challenge, the idea of building brain-like systems that can learn from their surroundings and show mind-like behaviors, like those Darwin Nomad robots, that seems like a more promising way to understand how minds might actually emerge.
Okay, so to do anything, including thinking, you need a system to do the work, the brain, in our case. But the thinking itself, like perceiving something or remembering, isn't a physical thing. It's the way our brain states relate to each other over time.
Exactly. Sensory signals carry information, and once they're processed by our sensory areas and reach the association cortex, they become what we experience as percepts, those process patterns, the things we see or hear. These percepts then trigger connections, associations in our brain, leading to the flow of our thoughts and our episodic memories. And that process, importantly, requires energy.
So thoughts are like smaller, more efficient activations in the brain. And thinking is essentially a sequence of these connected brain states. Our sources talk about a kind of spectrum of thought.
Yeah, that's right. On one end, you might have low verbal activity, but strong sensory cortex activation, like mental imagery. On the other end, you might have high verbal activation, that inner dialogue, with less sensory activation.
But often, our thoughts are a mix, right? Blending verbal and nonverbal processes. It seems more efficient and maybe makes symbolic reasoning easier.
Mm-hmm. Those verbal symbols essentially point to patterns of brain activity, neurodynamics. They lead either to actions or to other brain states, forming the sequences we experience as our thoughts.
So instead of getting bogged down trying to define mind or other mental concepts in some absolute way, the chapter suggests we should focus on studying the complex things our brains actually do. And it mentions the mereological fallacy. The idea that attributing thinking only to the whole person, not considering the brain's role, might be misleading, even while acknowledging the body is essential. Language here is more metaphorical than mathematically precise.
That's a good summary. It shifts the focus from definitions to functions and processes.
So how have people tried to describe this conscious mind throughout history? The chapter mentions early attempts, like in Buddhist Abhidharma, where they carefully observe their own mental states. Introspection.
Yes. And then we had introspective psychology later on, which tried something similar before, well, it became clear that observing your own thoughts reliably is much trickier than it sounds. Studying behavior and brain activity became more dominant.
Right. Phenomenological psychology, with thinkers like Husserl, took a slightly different approach, maybe moving a bit closer to some Eastern ways of thinking. And the modern debate about whether we can even accurately describe our inner experience is really highlighted in that book, Describing Inner Experience, Proponent Meets Skeptic. Sounds like a lively read.
It definitely is. And what's fascinating is that the very idea of consciousness is shaped by our culture and language. The subtle differences between English words like consciousness, awareness, and vigilance don't always translate perfectly into other languages.
That really highlights that how we even think about consciousness is influenced by the language we use. It's not just some universal inherent understanding. The chapter makes a distinction in Polish between przytomność, which is more about being alert, outward-focused, and świadomość, which includes that sense of self-awareness and broader context, more inward-looking too.
And samoświadomość, or self-awareness, requires us to have an explicit sense of self existing across time and in space. But trying to create rigid categories for these very fluid states can be unproductive, maybe even misleading, if we don't have clearly defined experimental ways to study them.
It seems like people have been wrestling with these distinctions for centuries. The chapter mentions Ralph Cudworth and John Maxwell making distinctions in the meanings of conscious way back. And more recently, we have all these different ways of carving it up. Primary versus reflexive, Damasio's levels, Bloch's access versus phenomenal consciousness.
Right. And given all these different viewpoints and labels, the chapter argues, quite persuasively, I think, that we need to concentrate on explaining specific phenomena rather than trying to define this one big umbrella concept of consciousness. Things like how specific conscious contents emerge, why we have illusions, the difference between conscious and unconscious processing, the subjective quality of experience, qualia, self-awareness, and the different states like waking, sleeping, hypnosis.
Yeah, focusing on the how rather than getting stuck on the what. That what is consciousness? The brain, from top to bottom resource, sounds useful for listeners wanting to dig deeper. And Bernard Barr's cognitive theory of consciousness, the global workspace theory, is presented as a psychological theory that tries to link our conscious experience to brain function.
Mm-hmm. Ultimately, to understand the difference between conscious and unconscious phenomena, we need to study the brain states associated with each, which brings us back to that idea of comparing conscious experiences to states where we're not conscious, contrastive analysis.
Okay, so our sources then provide a really helpful table contrasting examples of what's typically conscious versus unconscious or near conscious. On the conscious side, perceiving boundaries, mental images, inner dialogue, recalling memories, things we're generally aware of doing.
And on the unconscious side, things like the grammar rules we use automatically, inactive long-term memories, stuff temporarily outside our working memory focus, many automatic actions, procedural skills like riding a bike, and even that strange phenomenon of blindsight.
Blindsight is just wild, being able to react to visual stuff without actually being aware of seeing it. The chapter also brings up Sperling's experiments from way back, where people saw more letters flashed briefly than they could actually report afterwards.
Yeah, those experiments suggested that information might be held very briefly, maybe in iconic memory, before either getting selected for conscious processing or just fading away. It really makes you wonder what the brain's mechanism is for reading out or selecting some of that information to become conscious, what brings it onto the main stage.
Then we have those mental rotation experiments. Cooper and Shepard's work showing the time it takes to mentally rotate an object is proportional to the angle of rotation. It suggests our brains are actually doing some kind of internal spatial manipulation, like turning a real object.
Exactly. And the finding that experts in these tasks, like maybe Tetris players, show less conscious brain activity while doing them, that highlights how skills become automated. They require less conscious effort, less spotlight attention as we practice.
The attentional blink is another fascinating one, that brief period, maybe half a second or less, where you just can't perceive a second target if it appears right after the first one you attended to. And repetition blindness, where you might miss seeing a word if it's repeated quickly in a list, your brain just kind of skips over the second instance.
These effects are related to the broader idea of masking, which happens across all our senses, not just vision. We have masking in taste and smell, like how rinsing your mouth affects taste. Visual masking, when images are flashed quickly, one erasing the perception of the other. And auditory masking, which is actually used in things like MP3 compression to remove sounds we likely wouldn't hear anyway.
And then there's phonemic restoration, which is amazing. Our brains filling in missing sounds in speech if they're covered by noise, like a cough. That example where the same noisy sound followed by different words made listeners hear wheel, heel, peel, or meal, that really shows the power of context.
It beautifully demonstrates how our higher level understanding, our expectations, can actually shape our basic perception of what we think we hear. The main point here is that conscious impressions require specific brain reactions. The processes of activation and internal interpretation are complex. And things like neural inertia, the attentional blink, repetition blindness, they show that the brain can't just instantly analyze everything coming in one after another. Neurodynamics is a continuous flow.
So the subjective now that we experience isn't a sharp point in time, but more like a smeared out moment, a blend created by our brain integrating events happening within fractions of a second.
Which leads us to a really fundamental question. What's the actual function of consciousness? I mean, is it strictly necessary for us to function in the world? The chapter reminds us, quite rightly, that we perform a huge number of actions completely unconsciously.
Right. Our brains are constantly making plans, and often that conscious intention to act, the feeling I'm going to do this now, seems to pop into our awareness just before we actually do it. Sometimes maybe even after the process has started. Plus, the information our brains receive from the world is often ambiguous or incomplete.
And basic cognitive functions, perception, attention, planning, language, rely heavily on unconscious neural network activity. These networks are constantly detecting statistical regularities, patterns in the data, without us being aware of it. Even something as fundamental as seeing requires selection and integration of information. It's not just a passive recording. Helmholtz and Pierce recognized this long ago.
Learned automated behaviors, reading, walking, speaking our native language, can be executed almost entirely by these unconscious processes once they're well established.
Somehow, our brains manage to construct a single, coherent interpretation from countless unconscious processes. Recognizing shapes, objects, it involves collecting all these probabilistic assessments and settling on the most likely interpretation.
So the chapter argues that consciousness likely becomes necessary for novel problems, situations where we have to weigh different possibilities and our automatic responses just aren't sufficient. It's like needing an executive summary for complex decision-making, bringing the most important information into a shared workspace.
Yeah, it's the difference between us wrestling with a tough choice and, say, an insect just automatically reacting to a specific smell or light pattern. Experiments also show consciousness is needed for sequential actions, like multi-digit addition in your head. You need to hold the result of one step in conscious working memory to use it in the next. Unconscious processes seem to store information only very briefly.
And understanding language, especially complex sentences, requires holding the whole thing in working memory to grasp the meaning and the relationships between the parts. While we can have automatic responses without consciousness, engaging in a meaningful dialogue, reaching junk decisions that seems to require conscious awareness.
Which naturally brings up the big debate. Is our consciousness actually a causal factor in our decisions? Are we consciously choosing, or is it all just unfolding based on brain processes?
Right. Is consciousness driving the bus, or is it just along for the ride, maybe commenting on the scenery?
Some psychologists, like Velmans, Oakley, and Halligan mentioned in the sources, argue that consciousness isn't actually necessary to explain mental processes. They suggest that the feeling of being conscious is more of a result, a passive experience arising from information transfer within the brain, information becoming available in that global workspace, and our ability to then comment on or report that information.
It's the idea that we are whole organisms, not just this abstract mental self, even though that feeling of being a separate self is a very powerful illusion. It simplifies our understanding of complex self-regulation.
Mm-hmm. The chapter even mentions poets and earlier writers who touched on the sense of illusion, and it alludes to a previous discussion we had about decision-making and the rather challenging idea of a world without free will.
Okay, so to explore this causal role question further, let's revisit Bernard Barr's global workspace theory. The GW.
Right. Barr's proposed this system as essential for working memory. It allows interaction between different specialized information processing processors or modules in the brain.
So the GW is like a central bulletin board where the most highly activated processors can broadcast information to the entire system.
Exactly. It functions as a kind of working memory space that other specialized modules can access if the information is relevant to them.
And even simple processors involve networks of neurons making associations. But some can be quite complex modules dedicated to specific tasks, like language or spatial reasoning.
It's important to see the GW theory as a useful symbolic approximation, a way to describe the complex dynamics of brain processes. We saw how it could help explain things like restoring masked sounds in speech.
And it reminds us that most brain operations don't lead to conscious experiences. Our memory holds vast amounts of past events, representations. Thinking involves comparing stored representations with newly formed ones. Recognition memory, just knowing you've seen something before, often operates automatically.
Yeah, Sternberg's memory search experiments showed retrieval time doesn't depend on where an item is in a shortlist, suggesting parallel processing. And reading involves simultaneous processing at multiple levels.
The chapter also mentions language errors, like slips of the tongue saying, "I like the speaker," when you meant snake, perhaps. These happen at different levels of speech processing.
And visual perception, as we discussed, requires cooperation between multiple independent hierarchical processes. When context cues conflict, that's when we get visual illusions.
So the modularity of the mind, all these specialists, is really enabled by these incredibly efficient, unconscious, parallel processes working behind the scenes.
That's a key takeaway.
So what are the main characteristics of these unconscious processes? What makes them different?
Well, the chapter lists several key features. Functional unity, they work cohesively, but have some internal autonomy. Hierarchical or recursive organization processes are built from sub-processes. High internal information flow within these modules. Reusability, the same processors can be used for different tasks. And automation-frequent tasks become handled by relatively fixed processors.
It all sounds incredibly efficient. And as we saw with illusions, our conscious impressions are definitely shaped by context. The chapter then touches on the idea of a lingua mentalis, Fodor's concept, a universal language or code for these specialized modules to communicate. Is that plausible?
It's a theoretical idea. What we do observe is that the content of consciousness seems broadly accessible within the nervous system. Conscious mental images can even influence autonomic processes like heart rate.
Now, when we compare conscious and unconscious processes directly, the differences are stark, aren't they?
Very much so. Unconscious processors are typically efficient, parallel, fast, accurate, high capacity. Conscious processes, on the other hand, tend to be inefficient, slow, sequential, one thing at a time, low capacity, error prone, and they interfere with each other.
Interference.
Oh.
But that interference might actually be useful, right? It leads to associations across time, connecting different unconscious contexts. Context sensitivity.
That's a really interesting point. Perhaps that's part of the function. The brain evolved to process frequent stimuli consistently, aiding conscious decisions in varied, unpredictable situations. So conscious processes seem necessary precisely for solving novel tasks where the contexts are too complex for our automated systems.
The GW acts like a central committee, broadcasting information to the specialists. And its content, what's on the board, depends heavily on the current context, influenced by information from those less activated unconscious processors humming away in the background.
Right. And the coherence of our conscious thought seems to arise from competition. Only information that fits the overall pattern, the currently active gestalt, tends to get added. Strongly activated configurations tend to get reactivated, becoming those mental memes.
And our susceptibility to suggestion depends on which networks are already primed, ready to interpret incoming information based on recent events.
Which can be exploited, for instance, in marketing. But it can also be used constructively for self-regulation through self-instruction techniques like some aspects of NLP, though the source notes NLP's shift away from its scientific roots.
The sequential nature of consciousness, that stream-like feeling, seems to be a result of these competing contexts. The Necker cube illusion is a perfect example. Our perception flips because different neuronal groups in the visual cortex are competing for dominance.
Our sources give some rough time frames for these processes, maybe 100 milliseconds for initial data integration, around half a second for a message to be broadcast and received in the GW, leading to that conscious impression, and maybe 10 seconds for how long a message stays active in the GW, our short-term memory span.
It's amazing how fast yet sequential it feels. Brain scans, fMRI, show these cooperating groups of neurons' local workspaces emerging, with more integration needed for more difficult tasks.
Perhaps a very brief presence in the GW isn't enough for complex cooperation, which underlines the need for working memory to hold things longer.
New stimuli can initially cause widespread EEG activity, that orienting response, possibly involving the prefrontal cortex. You can almost see these bubbles of activity building up. Dehaene's model suggests conscious processing needs both attention and sufficient stimulus strength.
And the brain structures involved in this GW network are quite extensive. ERTIS, the thalamocorticobrainstem loop for perception, reticular formation, hypothalamus, NRT, and large parts of the cerebral cortex.
The world feels stable to us, the chapter suggests, because events generally align with our predictions. These predictions form the context for interpreting new events.
And there are different types of contexts influencing us. our self-model, often dominant, our current goals and intentions, and our conceptual expectations about how things should be.
We've all experienced fixation effects, or how expectations strongly influence perception. Visual illusions often highlight mismatches in these contextual expectations.
So, summarizing GW functioning, it sends messages out, usually one at a time. It interprets responses selectively based on context. It values information that reduces uncertainty, and it habituates. It tunes out predictable data.
Problem solving often seems to follow a pattern, a kind of triad. First, we consciously frame the task.
Then our unconscious brain does the heavy lifting, the computation.
And finally, the solution often just appears in our conscious awareness.
Exactly. And it doesn't always require intense conscious effort. Sometimes just focusing your attention and having an expectation that a solution will come is enough to trigger the process. We see this triad not just in problem solving, but in spontaneous creative actions, controlling simple movements, the ideomotor theory connection, planning complex tasks, perceiving ambiguous figures, and even memory recall, that tip of the tongue feeling where you know it, and you just wait for it to surface.
That connects to William James's ideomotor theory of will. The idea or image of an action leads to the signal for the action, and then the action happens.
Right. And importantly, this doesn't necessarily require conscious effort or a distinct act of willing. Actions can arise spontaneously when we're kind of ripe for them, aligned with whatever goal context is currently dominant. This view suggests there might not be a separate will or volitional control system, just spontaneous action emerging from the strongest goal context.
What about those unwanted thoughts that pop into your head when you're trying to focus? Are we willing those?
Probably not consciously. The theory suggests we simply become aware of what our brain produces. And what the brain produces is still part of ourself, even if it feels intrusive. We feel like we're acting consciously when we're aware of the goals and the chain of associations leading to our thoughts or sensations. But spontaneous thoughts are just things we consciously notice after they've already started forming.
The chapter uses the example of imagining a swinging pendulum actually leading to tiny unconscious movements. It relates this to things like spiritualist seances and the Ouija board, where Faraday found unconscious muscle pressure was responsible.
It really shows the subtle influence of thought on action, even unconsciously. Mistakes and slips of the tongue, the sources suggest, might happen when the GW doesn't have enough time to edit the messages coming up from unconscious processes. That could be why we sometimes repeat ourselves or do slightly irrelevant things while our brain is still figuring out the best response.
And automatisms, those actions done without thinking.
They seem to arise when there's a lack of influence from competing goal contexts on the GW. One process just runs automatically. Bad habits can form this way too, through repeated role-playing, strengthening specific neural pathways until they become dominant and hard to override.
Psychology has recently become more interested in these spontaneous processes, mind-wandering, unintentional memory recall.
Understanding these is key, the chapter argues, to resolving that old philosophical paradox of infinite regress. To consciously think about something, would you first need to consciously think about thinking about it? And so on.
Right. How does the first conscious thought get initiated?
The idea is that these spontaneous thoughts bubble up. What does the conscious self know about them before they become clear? Probably not much, until an internal activation, like an episodic memory trace, becomes sufficiently strong and clear.
And sometimes, weaker activations might bypass conscious awareness entirely.
Yeah.
Associative areas could influence motor areas directly.
Exactly. And the self might only become aware of it through the resulting external action, thinking, oh, I just did that. The example of musicians is great here. Some can internally imagine sounds perfectly, while others can only recognize the correct sound after hearing it played. It shows the brain can know something the conscious self doesn't have direct access to.
Antonio Damasio offers a different way to frame consciousness with his three levels. Can you walk us through those?
Sure. First, there's the proto-self. This is linked to the brainstem, basic homeostatic processes regulating body temperature, blood sugar, etc. It provides a fundamental awareness of the body's internal state, forming what he calls background consciousness, just the basic feeling of being alive.
Okay, the foundation. What's next?
Core consciousness. This builds on the proto-self. It involves the brain's maps of the body interacting with maps of the environment. It gives rise to a subjective, moment-by-moment representation of the organism interacting with the world, grounded in the here and now. It requires memory to link these moments.
So, awareness of the present, linked to the body, and the third level.
The autobiographical self. This relies on the images generated by core consciousness, but adds the ability to manipulate these images through internal simulation thinking, planning, remembering. And crucially, language plays a big role here, allowing us to create a narrative, a story of self across time. This requires extensive memory and reasoning abilities.
So for Damasio, consciousness is essentially knowing about your own existence as an organism and knowing about your surroundings.
Yes, and later he put even more emphasis on homeostasis, emotions, and their fundamental role in driving survival and well-being, which underpins all these levels.
Can we actually measure consciousness? Like assign a number to how conscious someone is?
Well, people are trying. One idea is integrated information theory, or IIT, developed by Tononi and Koch. It tries to quantify consciousness by measuring the amount of integrated information in a system. It looks at both differentiation, how many different states the system can be in, and integration, how interconnected and synchronized those states are. EEG signal complexity is one potential way to measure this in brains.
But IIT has its challenges, right? The panpsychism problem.
Exactly. The mathematics of IIT might assign some degree of consciousness, a value called phi, to systems we wouldn't normally think of as conscious at all. Maybe genetic networks, complex social systems, even power grids. The argument is that while an index based on complexity might correlate with states like wakefulness versus anesthesia in brains, in other complex systems, it might just reflect intricate information integration without any of the other features we associate with consciousness, like subjective experience, self-awareness, intentionality.
It's like using the word space in physics versus using it in agriculture. Same word. Very different meaning and implications.
Precisely. It might be measuring something related to complexity and integration, but calling it consciousness across the board could be misleading.
This naturally leads to the connection between consciousness theories and the development of artificial intelligence.
Yes, our sources mention a paper by Butlin and colleagues that summarizes six main testable theories of consciousness relevant to AI. These include things like recurrent processing theory, global workspace theory, higher order theories, predictive processing, and attention schema theory.
And what was the conclusion regarding current AI?
The conclusion was that while no current AI model really meets all the criteria derived from these theories to be considered conscious, there don't seem to be any fundamental technical barriers preventing it in the future. The potential is there.
Let's briefly touch on a couple of those specific theories. Recurrent processing theory.
That's Victor Lam's theory. It suggests three types of information processing. A fast feed-forward sweep from senses to motor output, unconscious. Local recurrent processing within sensory areas, extracting features, maybe some basic awareness, and global recurrent processing involving feedback loops across many brain areas. It's this global processing, widely available, that corresponds to conscious content.
Okay, and attention schema theory, AST.
That's Michael Graziano's idea. He proposes that subjective awareness is essentially a schematic model that the brain builds of its own attentional processes. Just like the brain builds a model of the body schema, it builds a simplified model of attention to monitor and control how it selects information. This model of attention, this attention schema, is what we experience as awareness of things. It gives us a sense of consciously possessing or focusing on information. Graziano argues this allows systems to claim consciousness and make predictions about others' awareness. It connects back to Locke's idea of perceiving what happens in our own minds.
Interesting. So awareness is the brain's model of its own attention. Our sources caution against overly simplistic explanations for consciousness, though, like just pointing to specific neuron types, like Vange-Conemo neurons found in certain large-brain animals.
Right. Correlation doesn't equal causation. Just finding a particular cell type doesn't tell you how consciousness arises. We need to understand the entire process, the information flow, the transformations within the network, to grasp complex mental functions. Different theories tend to focus on different aspects of neural activity, drawing evidence from healthy brains, neurological disorders, psychiatric conditions. It's possible they might eventually be integrated into a larger picture.
The chapter then offers a seemingly simple view. Maybe any brain-like system must have sensations and claim consciousness.
How so?
Well, if sensory stimuli create physical states in the system, and the system reacts to those states, and importantly, can internally comment on those states, like associating a specific internal state with the label "tastes like strawberry," then those comments are based on real physical states, not just arbitrary rules. The system is describing its own internal reality.
That's a provocative thought. It grounds the claim of consciousness in the system's ability to report on its own physically instantiated states.
To make this more concrete, the sources use an example contrasting a simple organism with a more complex one.
Yeah, like a hungry paramecium just moving towards nutrients versus a thirsty animal that needs to plan how to find water. The latter requires memory, goals, more complex internal processing.
And it gives a step-by-step breakdown of what might happen in our brain when we feel thirsty.
Right. The hypothalamus signals a need for water, sensory systems report dryness, the temporal cortex interprets this, the frontal cortex creates a goal, find water, the hippocampus recalled possible water sources, the parietal cortex might create a mental image, the prefrontal cortex plans the action, the frontal cortex executes it.
And crucially, the temporal cortex might provide the justification, the commentary, I'm looking for water because I'm thirsty. That internal reporting piece.
Which leads to the argument that any system capable of sophisticated communication, like using language, probably can't function effectively as a zombie without some ability to interpret its own internal states and explain its actions.
It needs that working memory, that global workspace, to summarize key internal parameters for commentary. And if an artificial brain states become sufficiently similar to ours,
then its commentaries, its claims of experience, could become indistinguishable from ours. It's a gradual path, perhaps.
So the conclusion on consciousness and AI.
Consciousness seems to arise from a specific organization of information processing, unique to brains with their dynamic processes. It can potentially arise in artificial systems if they have appropriately organized brains. But achieving personality, the subtle nuances of a human mind, that's a much, much harder challenge than just achieving basic awareness or self-reporting.
That brings us nicely to personality and identity. There's this dilemma, isn't there? Personality needs to be stable enough for us to be recognizable, yet adaptable enough to learn and change.
Exactly. How much should external criticism, for instance, alter how you see yourself? It's a constant balancing act.
From a brain process perspective, what are the main causes of individual differences?
Our sources point to two main factors. First, differences in our connectomes, the specific wiring patterns in our brains. These are shaped by genetics, but crucially also by our unique life experiences. Second, differences in the speed of neuroplastic changes. How quickly our brain adapts and learns at various levels. We see this in how quickly people adapt to things like the waterfall illusion, for example. The rate of adaptation varies.
So those two factors, wiring and plasticity speed, roughly determine our average brain processes and how much they vary.
That's the general idea. There's research looking into how we self-stabilize without just deceiving ourselves and how personality functions in social contexts. The question of the soul, as you mentioned, is left for other discussions.
Okay, but this raises a potentially unsettling question. If our decisions are just brain processes unfolding, does that mean we don't really exist? What about responsibility? Are we just automata?
That's a common concern, but the sources offer a counter perspective. It's not, I have a brain, but rather the brain has I. The I, the sense of self, is part of the brain and body's functioning. We are our brain and body more than just that feeling of self.
So no simple cause and effect.
Right. Everything is interconnected. Brain states aren't strictly deterministic like simple automata. They depend massively on individual history and the unique confluence of events happening right now. It's more probabilistic and complex. Think of the quantum analogy again, particles lacking defined properties until observed. Our brain states are similarly dynamic and context dependent.
So the argument is that we are responsible for our brains and therefore for our behavior, even when our actions surprise us.
Yes. Externalizing blame completely might even relate to specific brain activity patterns, perhaps a lack of integration or control over impulses. The split brain examples also suggest responsibility holds even when oneself claims lack of intent.
But if it's all just brain activations, does life lose its meaning?
The sources argue no, meaning persists. Does understanding the chemistry of a rose make it smell less sweet? Probably not. Meaning comes from our experiences, relationships, goals. Perhaps poets have more insight here than neuroscience. And consider the alternative. Eternal life might involve infinite repetition, potentially becoming meaningless. Impermanence and change are part of life's richness.
Okay, let's shift back to the brain itself. What neural activity actually correlates with conscious experiences? The neural correlates of consciousness or NCCs?
Attention is key, as we've discussed. And synchronized groups of neurons firing together, possibly around the 40 hertz gamma frequency range, though that's still debated. This synchronization might be crucial for binding different features of an experience together.
Experiments show attention significantly boosts activity in relevant areas, like the visual cortex, way beyond just passively observing something.
And using ambiguous stimuli like the Necker cube or binocular rivalry, where each eye sees a different image, is really useful. The external input stays the same, but conscious perception flips, allowing researchers to track the corresponding changes in brain activity.
So the idea is that neuron synchronization creates a strong enough signal in the brain to become associated with symbolic commentary, like the phonological representations linked to language areas.
That's one prominent line of thinking, yes. It allows the state to be broadcast or accessed by other systems, including those involved in reporting or reflecting. Instead of getting stuck on the hard problem, why subjectivity exists at all, the sources suggest focusing on the easy problems, like how a brain-like system would describe its states, likely using metaphors, comparisons, drawing on its learned associations.
And there's ongoing debate about specific brain areas. Does V1, the primary visual cortex, contribute directly to conscious vision?
It's debated. It might depend on the strength of feedback signals from higher visual areas, which could vary between people, maybe explaining differences in visual imagery vividness. This highlights the need for good neurophenomenology, as Varela called it, carefully mapping brain activity to detailed descriptions of subjective experience. That Hurlbert Schwitzgebel book touches on the challenges here.
And the relationship isn't always simple, right? Does a louder sound automatically mean stronger overall neural activation?
Not necessarily. Neural activity is an internal code. Loudness perception might depend more on which specific neurons are activated or the pattern of activation rather than just the sheer number firing.
We have to learn to interpret our own brain states, learn which sensations correspond to which experiences. Even as adults, we can misattribute sensory input sometimes. Schwitzgebel gives an example of confusing touch with echoed sound.
Exactly. It's a learned skill, interpreting the brain's internal signals.
Which brain structures are absolutely critical for consciousness, for having mental states at all?
Well, damage to the brainstem, particularly the ascending reticular activating system, ARS, can lead to coma. ARS provides arousal, the basic level of alertness needed for coherent brain activity and information integration. Without it, the cortex can't maintain the synchronized activity needed for consciousness.
Temporal lobe epilepsy can also cause temporary loss of consciousness.
Yes. And studying anesthesia is informative. We see a sequential fading of different aspects of consciousness, often linked to a loss of differentiated synchronization between brain areas. You might see very slow delta waves or hypersynchronous alpha waves, often starting in the frontal cortex.
So a key mechanism seems to be blocking communication between neurons by forcing them into overly synchronous activity. Too much lockstep prevents complex processing.
That seems to be a major factor. There was that fascinating single case study where electrical stimulation near the claustrum and anterior insula caused rapid, reversible loss of consciousness in an epilepsy patient.
What happened in the brain during that?
Interestingly, they noted increased synchronization between parietal and frontal areas during the unconscious period, which aligns with observations in epilepsy. It suggests too much synchronization might disrupt normal information transfer, perhaps via the thalamus, but it's just one case, raising more questions.
And more recent experiments point towards the anterior insular cortex, the AIC.
Yes, studies from 2021 suggest the AIC plays a key role in accessing sensory information consciously. Anesthesia disrupted AIC activity and its connection with attention and default mode networks. Crucially, whether someone consciously perceived a weak visual signal near the threshold could be predicted by AIC activation before the signal appeared. This led to the hypothesis that the AIC acts as a kind of gate or filter for conscious sensory access.
Let's talk about personal identity again. Why do we feel like the same person over time, even though our bodies are constantly changing? Cells die and are replaced at different rates.
It's an ancient puzzle. Cratylus argued you couldn't even have a discussion because the speaker, listener, and word meanings are always changing.
So why the feeling of continuity?
The argument is that while cells change, the core identity structures in the brain, the patterns of connections, the stored memories that define our personality and history are relatively stable. They're only significantly altered by major events like brain damage, significant aging effects, or maybe severe hormonal imbalances.
What about future possibilities, like detailed brain models or mind transfer?
The sources suggest that even imperfect copies, capturing the essential functional patterns, could likely replicate thinking, reactions, and behavior to a large degree. Think about digital audio or video compression loses data, but the experience can be very similar. While some neurons die, identity is preserved because the system can often compensate for these micro-level disturbances. The overall pattern remains.
But this raises huge philosophical questions.
Huh.
If you make a perfect copy of a brain, is the copy the same eye as the original?
That's the paradox. The copy would feel and react exactly like the original, claim to be the original, but is it? What if the original remains? What if you make multiple copies?
Imagine falling asleep, and only a copy remains when you wake up. Is that immortality, or did the original I disappear?
Each copy would feel like the original. It seems obvious, yet deeply strange. Hofstadter and Dennett explored these kinds of problems extensively, often using literary examples.
How do we even know the world existed yesterday? Our sense of identity relies heavily on memory when we wake up. Total amnesia would erase that sense of continuous self.
Right. And what if your consciousness was transferred to an artificial body? You'd likely feel a sense of continuity.
But what if it was transferred simultaneously to multiple artificial bodies? Each would feel like the original I, possess self-preservation instincts. Merging them back together seems unlikely.
And after the transfer, each copy's history would immediately start to diverge. They'd have different experiences, form different memories, and become distinct identities over time, especially if the artificial bodies lasted longer than biological ones.
It's science fiction for now, but it highlights our strong intuition that I is a single, locatable, transferable thing.
We have trouble imagining our own non-existence. We didn't have a clear sense of I as infants, but we understand the concept of other things not existing.
Jesse Baring's experiments show that even non-believers tend to attribute mental states, like beliefs, to the deceased, even if they don't attribute perception or physical needs. The idea of a mind persisting is somehow intuitive.
And when we imagine things, we put ourselves in a single viewpoint. It's hard to conceive of being in multiple positions simultaneously. Sean Nichols noted the paradox of trying to imagine one's own non-existence. You're always there, imagining it.
So our difficulty with mind cloning might stem from a similar source, wondering where I is if multiple copies exist. Logically, each copy would simply feel like I.
The conclusion offered is that I exists only when the brain functions. There's no single true self that gets copied. Each functional copy is a self. The question, which one is mine, is ultimately meaningless from an objective standpoint, even though it feels subjectively crucial.
It's like species identity changing slowly, versus how we can rapidly change animal breeds through selection, creating diverse offspring that are partial copies.
A single personality could similarly be modified by new conditions to create many others. Think of the movie Trading Places environment dramatically impacting behavior and personality over time.
Philosophers have debated identity for ages, Thomas Reed, Joseph Priestley. And modern thinkers like Hofstadter, Dennett, Parfit have tackled teleportation paradoxes and the nature of personal identity.
There are even interesting modern phenomena, like people identifying deeply with fantasy characters online. It starts as role-playing, but can be reinforced by communities, potentially leading to real shifts in self-perception. Research on that is still limited, though.
Let's shift gears to atypical states of consciousness. Hypnosis, for example. How is that defined?
It's generally described as a state of heightened suggestibility and focused attention, often leading to reduced awareness of peripheral stimuli, almost like being completely engrossed in a book or movie and tuning everything else out.
And it can be induced in various ways, even self-hypnosis.
Yes. Milton Erickson developed specific language models for inducing trance states, sometimes used in medical hypnosis. Studies show altered brain activity during hypnosis, often slower EEG oscillations.
What are the main theories trying to explain hypnosis?
There are several psychological theories. Hilgar's neo-dissociation theory suggests a split in higher-level control systems. Some functions operate normally, but awareness of them is blocked. Others combine reduced executive attention with misattributing the cause of behavior. Sociocognitive theories emphasize the role of expectation and misinterpreting suggested actions as involuntary. There are also neurophysiological models proposing stages involving different brain areas and theories based on conditioning or the idea of acting on suggestion without higher order thoughts about one's own mental state.
What about older ideas linking it to imagination taking over?
Those often involved ideas like right hemisphere dominance, which neuroimaging hasn't really supported. It's possible no special mechanism for hypnosis exists, and it's all explainable by imagination and suggestibility. Highly suggestible people sometimes spontaneously enter trance-like states.
Is hypnotizability linked to specific personality traits?
The strongest correlations are with tendencies towards dissociation, feeling detached, and absorption, getting easily engrossed. It doesn't seem strongly linked to other major personality traits. Suggestions during hypnosis can involve compelled actions, hallucinations, memory alterations. People often report feeling like the suggested behaviors happen to them independently of their will.
Hypnotizability seems quite stable from childhood and similar in identical twins. Rituals and ceremonies might induce similar states of focused consciousness.
The hypnotic state seems to involve deep absorption and ideomotor control, movement control, without conscious deliberation enabled by focus and the absence of competing thoughts or goals. This can lead to dissociation and altered time perception. Post-hypnotic amnesia feels similar to how time disappears during absorbing activities.
What about dissociative disorders, more generally, or mind-altering substances?
Dissociative disorders cover a range of phenomena where aspects of identity, memory, or consciousness become disconnected. They have diverse causes. The sources mention scopolamine, found in plants like Datura. It causes hallucinations and severe memory impairment by blocking certain receptors, primarily in the temporal lobes. This leads to a zombie-like state of obedience.
Why obedience?
Because the memory impairment prevents evaluation of actions and consequences. It makes people highly suggestible and suspends free will, as conscious choice requires understanding outcomes. It also dulls pain perception. Historically, it was used in some rituals.
What's happening in the brain during hypnosis, neurophysiologically?
Hypnosis and absorption states tend to show reduced activity in the default mode network, DMN, the network active during mind wandering, and increased activity in attentional networks in the prefrontal cortex. TMS studies suggest overall activity, but perhaps weaker control signals between parietal and frontal areas.
Has the scientific view of hypnosis changed?
Yes, hypnotherapy gained more credibility after a British Psychological Society report in 2001 acknowledged its potential benefits in certain contexts.
Okay, let's talk about near-death experiences, NDEs. What are we actually talking about here?
It's crucial to clarify NDEs experiences like out-of-body sensations. Seeing tunnels or lights are typically associated with cardiac arrest, not irreversible brain death. Consciousness is lost very quickly when circulation stops, but the brain isn't immediately damaged beyond repair, and circulation is sometimes restored.
So what might be happening during that critical period?
One suggestion is that NDEs resemble lucid dreams, a state between waking and sleep where parts of the prefrontal cortex remain active, unlike typical REM sleep. REM is normally associated with dreaming and muscle paralysis.
Some people experience waking dreams or REM intrusion, right?
Yes, a mix of REM and waking states, maybe in 20-25% of people. This is linked to brainstem activity and is more common in those prone to NDEs and sleep disorders. Circulatory problems might trigger REM-like states in susceptible individuals. It's also hypothesized that reduced activity in the locus coeruleus, a brainstem area involved in stress response, during NDEs might disinhibit areas that produce euphoria. Tunnel vision could result from peripheral vision fading first during fainting or oxygen deprivation, while central vision and higher visual cortex remain active longer.
And the out-of-body feeling.
That might be linked to disrupted activity in the temporoparietal junction, TPJ, which is involved in integrating sensory information to create our normal sense of self-location and body ownership. Even octopuses show a REM-like sleep phase.
What about mystical states? William James wrote extensively about these.
Yes, in The Varieties of Religious Experience. He even experimented with hallucinogens himself, describing feelings of unity mixed with fear. We now know blocking specific serotonin receptors, 5-HT2A, can prevent these drug-induced experiences.
James thought the value of these experiences lay in their fruits, their effects on a person's life, not their origin.
Right. Hallucinogens seem to cause unusual patterns of connectivity between brain areas, leading to novel combinations of sensations and thoughts, often accompanied by a subjective sense of profound insight that might not seem so profound later.
Sensory deprivation, like in float tanks, can also induce hallucinations as the brain, lacking external input, activates the DMN and accesses memories. Prolonged deprivation might lead to unique states with altered time-space perception, sometimes interpreted mystically.
Neurotheology studies these links between brain activity and spiritual experiences. Research involves scanning experienced meditators or attempting to induce religious-like states with brain stimulation, like Persinger's controversial God helmet.
Does inducing such experiences artificially invalidate them?
The sources suggest they are brain-generated phenomena occurring under specific conditions, not necessarily proof of a supernatural realm. Dean Hamer's genetic studies found correlations between self-transcendence traits and certain genes, like VMAT2, the God gene, suggesting a partial genetic predisposition, but not linked to specific religions.
Evolution seems to trend towards more flexible, continuous categories beyond fixed sensory responses.
There's maybe a trade-off between being fully present in the moment and the broadened perspective of an expert who sees more connections but might lose some immediacy due to cognitive processing drawing resources from sensory areas.
While chaotic states can be complex, mystical states often lack distinct features, perhaps offering only an illusion of deep understanding. Neurofeedback technology is increasingly being explored as a way to influence brain states, potentially supplementing meditation.
Let's return to self-awareness. What's its evolutionary advantage?
Knowing one's own body and actions allows for self-care beyond basic instincts, grooming, tending to injuries. The Gallup mirror test, recognizing oneself in a mirror, is seen as a better indicator of self-recognition than just cautious behavior.
But our self-awareness is limited, isn't it? We feel pain, but we don't directly perceive issues with internal organs unless they cause symptoms. Pain perception itself isn't always tied directly to sensory nerve activation, thinks psychosomatic pain.
And what about qualia, the subjective aspects of consciousness?
That's the philosophical concept for the raw feel of experience, the redness of red, the taste of vanilla. Philosophers debate whether these can ever be fully reduced to physical phenomena, like the meaning of a word isn't just the ink on the page. We can't know exactly what another person experiences taste. Perception varies widely. And whether a robot could have genuine subjective experiences remains a deep question.
Do we even really know what we like? The correlation between our stated preferences and our actual brain reactions or choices could be surprisingly weak. Research showing brain responses predict music hits better than surveys is fascinating.
It suggests the brain might know better than the conscious eye. So what do we truly know about ourselves and how? Dehanan puts it starkly. Learning who we are requires statistical inference based on observation.
Our internal information flow isn't easily analyzed by ourselves. External observers can sometimes predict our decisions as well as we can, despite having less information. Personality assessment from digital footprints points to this too.
We learn about ourselves by observing our actions, the environment's reactions, and others' responses. Language helps describe external things, but internal states are harder to pin down and label accurately. Learning about our own feelings is challenging.
And humans are masters of self-deception, aren't we? Believing our own lies, creating stories, confabulations to justify irrational judgments.
Research even shows that benefiting from unethical behavior can paradoxically improve self-perception in some cases.
How can I deceive itself? If we identify only with a conscious I instead of the whole organism, we're essentially just building a theory of our own mind, not grasping our true nature.
It's important to distinguish simple awareness, alertness, processing stimuli, from self-awareness. Robots can be aware in the first sense, reacting to objects, reporting states.
But that doesn't require an internal world model or self-reference. It can be purely sensorimotor.
So why does the brain need self-awareness, a sense of I? Our brains build an internal world model with two key interacting parts. Episodic memory allows us to replay and recombine past experiences, enabling imagination and reasoning internally. And reference to the physical world lets us use the environment as an external memory aid, thinking by doing. Even vague mental imagery helps us identify and refer to things. We create new qualities by combining memory with external tools.
Thoughts and imagination become possible by identifying and categorizing brain states linked to past experiences.
And remember, we don't perceive reality directly, but our brain's reactions to external or internal stimulation. So vivid imagination and observation aren't fundamentally different types of brain states.
Thoughts are sequences of brain states activating language areas, leading to symbolic word representations. This influences the structure of thought. Non-linguistic brains rely more heavily on direct associations.
So the argument goes, there's no fundamental mystery of consciousness beyond understanding these complex brain processes. The feeling of mystery might be an illusion created by language and introspection. Any sufficiently complex brain-like system analyzing data and forming memories must be aware of external and internal states. Self-awareness, I, arises as a way to model the perceived source of actions and intentions driven by needs.
Mind isn't static matter, but dynamic information processing.
Yes, a transient configuration arising from the interaction of physical brain structure and stored memory, habits, knowledge, experiences. Memory is dead until activated into fleeting representations, thoughts, percepts.
Descartes' noted thought doesn't occupy physical space. The analogy of a computer game character is useful. Visible, reactive, but temporary, requiring the physical hardware.
Mind, like that avatar, needs an active substrate. The substrate is material, but the pattern of activity, the character's reactions moment to moment, isn't physically persistent beyond that moment. Game situations emerge from interaction, like the stream of thought. The immateriality lies in this transient configuration of energy flow, electrical current, screen pixels, sound waves arising and disappearing, possibly never repeating exactly.
Waking from dreamless sleep feels like a rebirth, the mind reactivating. It makes mind transfer paradoxes even stranger. If copied, are you the same? I. What happens to the original?
There's a mystery there. Perhaps the only way to resolve it is to accept we disappear nightly and are reborn upon waking, with continuity provided by memory and social context.
What about the idea that the brain is just a receiver for consciousness, like a TV picking up a signal?
That idea often comes from introspection. We feel our hand is us, but we don't directly perceive our brain. Mental processes feel different from physical ones. It leads to asking if thought needs a non-material mind directing the brain.
But the sources strongly argue against the receiver hypothesis.
Right. Overwhelmingly so. It's inconsistent with everything we know. Consciousness develops with brain structures. Other mammals have similar neurons, where they need separate animal spirit realms. Brain function looks like a learning computer, not a passive receiver. Our models explain sensations, illusions, effects of brain damage, neuropsychological disorders. Out-of-body illusions show the brain creates our reality representation. We can trace needs, motivations, plans leading to decisions within the brain. We become aware of plans after the brain initiates them.
And specific brain damage profoundly alters personality and conscious content. Split personalities show one brain can run multiple self programs. Brain effort correlates with task difficulty. A receiver wouldn't need to try harder. Placebo effects show expectations have real physiological impact.
None of these facts make sense if the brain is just receiving signals or if mind is detached. The receiver idea seems like a remnant of magical thinking, incompatible with neuroscience.
Where do decisions and beliefs originate then? Saying I want to doesn't explain the wanting.
That wanting arises from neural processes, sometimes surprising us. Our beliefs result from past experiences shaping brain function. Our viewpoint is a product of our history. Change is usually gradual. Conversion might happen when one established complex of ideas wins out over another.
If ancient physics was wrong, maybe ancient metaphysics is too. It hasn't progressed much.
The spirit over matter view can be harmful, leading to complacency about brain health or addiction. Physical brain changes are hard to reverse.
Most people don't understand computers, but trust experts do. Will understanding the mind follow a similar path as AI advances?
Probably. As artificial minds become more sophisticated and human-like, trust in experts explaining the brain-mind link will likely grow. Saying we can't build conscious robots without defining consciousness is like saying we couldn't build clocks without defining time perfectly first. We build based on functional understanding.
Is the brain too complex to replicate soon?
That's likely wishful thinking. The basic structure of the cortex is relatively uniform, its function increasingly understood. We're modeling operating principles, not every single molecule. The modeling process is converging, with useful models for nearly all cognitive phenomena. Creating detailed models is challenging, but there seem to be no fundamental barriers to artificial, self-aware minds. Home robots will likely accelerate cognitive robotics and brain modeling due to increased funding and data.
There's a spectrum of complexity, from simple reflexes to human thought. Primates are conscious, experience emotions. Why would sufficiently complex artificial brain-like systems be fundamentally different?
Even simple neural nets show introspective-like features because of how they're built. It's arguably technically harder to program a convincing rule-based chatterbot than to have a neural network interpret its own activation patterns as sensations. Real feeling communication requires internal reactions interpreted as experience.
What about more exotic theories of consciousness, quantum effects, electromagnetic fields?
They have appeal, but struggle to explain experimental results related to perception, anesthesia, consciousness disorders, drug effects. Biophysics, connectomics, neural synchronization studies seem sufficient, leading to skepticism among most experts about exotic theories. Conscious processes are slow, milliseconds. Quantum effects are incredibly fast. Sustained, immediate synchronization across the brain would likely cause seizures, not differentiated thought. Chemical synapses allow for diverse, simultaneous states.
Correlation versus causation again. Is brain activity just correlated with feelings?
The evidence suggests causation. Losing senses removes awareness of those sensations. Sensory deprivation reduces mental activity. Disrupting specific brain areas removes awareness of specific features like color or motion. Appropriate brain information processing is necessary for subjective experience. Visual illusions confirm this. The brain state, not reality, dictates perception. The interaction causes the experience.
And we can now read out brain states with increasing accuracy.
Yes. Decoding sounds from auditory cortex, images from visual cortex, fMRI, even emotions and intentions. Huff's 2023 work generating text from fMRI during storytelling is remarkable. Direct cortical access would allow even more detail.
So the conclusion seems unequivocal.
Brain activations cause the images, thoughts, and intentions in our consciousness. The idea of controlling robots with thoughts via an internet of brains remains purely utopian for now.
So wrapping this all up, while definitively defining consciousness in a single, neat way remains maybe impossible or at least incredibly challenging, what's truly remarkable is how much we are learning about the intricate brain processes that actually give rise to our personal experience of the world.
Absolutely. And the understanding that we're not just passive recipients of reality, but actively constructing it based on our brain's ongoing interpretations, that's a truly game-changing perspective, I think.
Hopefully, this deep dive has offered you, our listener, a fascinating new way to think about your own thoughts, perceptions, and maybe even those curious moments when your brain seems to, well, play tricks on you. Understanding the complex how behind consciousness is an incredibly powerful tool for gaining deeper insights into ourselves and the world around us.
Yeah, and considering how intimately our conscious experience is linked to the dynamic, ever-changing activity within our brains, mm-hmm. it really makes you ponder the fundamental nature of self mm-hmm. and its potential for transformation or perhaps even replication in ways we're only just beginning to imagine. What does that future look like?
A provocative thought indeed. Thank you for joining us for this deep dive.